Welcome to the Democracy Paradox Podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the Democracy Paradox. In recent years, some of the most dramatic setbacks for democracy have happened in West Africa and the Sahel. We've begun to see a resurgence of military coups in Niger, Burkina Faso, Gabon, Sudan, Guinea, Chad, and Mali. Nearly every time the military seizes power, democracy faces another major regression. Moreover, it's difficult for those countries to fully recover even after the military cedes power. The resurgence of military coups caught many off guard, because after the Cold War, they had nearly disappeared. The few coups that did happen were met with strong sanctions, forcing those involved to back down or face pariah status. But the world has changed, and it raises questions about what factors made coups more likely during the Cold War. Adam Casey argues it was military aid from Western countries like the United States that provided the conditions for militaries to seize power during those years. His recent book, Up in Arms, How Military Aid Stabilizes and Destabilizes Foreign Autocrats, makes a somewhat controversial but powerful argument about the effectiveness of military aid. Adam is currently an analyst in the United States government. You might recognize his name because he has co-written papers with a lot of past guests on the show, including Dan Slater, Lucan Way, and Stephen Levitsky. His new book was written while he was a research fellow at the Weiser Center for Emerging Democracies at the University of Michigan. Now, let me emphasize, all the content in the book and this interview reflects the views of the author and does not reflect the position of any U.S. government agency or department, nor does it assert or imply U.S. government authentication of information, or endorsement of the author's views. My conversation with Adam explores how military aid strengthened some regimes and destabilized others. It considers how the different approaches of the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War played a large role in regime stability. We consider the lessons from this period for the military aid we provide now to fight terrorism. But the ideas discussed also say something important about institutions and how their fit can provide regime stability or instability in democracies and autocracies. The Democracy Paradox is proud to count as one of its sponsors, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Their Democracy, Conflict, and Governance program is a leading source of research and ideas about supporting democracy globally. You can learn more at ceip.org/programs/democracy. The podcast is also sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute was founded by Guillermo O'Donnell, one of the giants of democratic thought more than 40 years ago. It continues to sponsor research on democracy and human development. Check them out at kellogg.nd.edu. You'll find a link in the show notes to their website. Like always, you can send questions or comments to me at jkempf@democracyparadox.com. But for now, this is my conversation with Adam Casey. Adam Casey, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Welcome. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, Adam, I was really impressed with your book. I thought it was one of those books that touches on political science and international affairs that really has something not just profound to say, but something that's unique and different and gets us to think about some of these issues in a way that kind of challenges our typical assumptions. I should mention that your book is called Up in Arms, How Military Aid Stabilizes and Destabilizes Foreign Autocrats.
So just from the subtitle there, I think it raises a really important question that everybody's going to want to know. Why would military aid actually destabilize a foreign autocrat?
That's a great question. Yeah. So first of all, thanks so much for saying the kind words. I think, you know, these books are really long and sometimes lonely processes. So it's really fun to have people find something insightful or interesting from them when it ends up finally kind of coming across the finish line. So yeah, I mean, the book is kind of, you know, the book emerged about 10 years ago out of this project where I wanted to look at, you know, what the relationship between foreign military and economic support and the stability of authoritarian regimes really is. I think it's one of those relationships that's often posited by people that, you know, certain autocrats are kind of propped up by foreign aid, and that, you know, in order to understand their durability, we need to look not just at the sort of their own politics, but also at the preferences and behaviors of places like Washington, Moscow, Beijing, Paris, et cetera. And so the book tries to actually really, you know, sort of systematically investigate, like, what is the real relationship between, you know, sort of military aid and the stability of allied dictators? And, you know, the finding is that it isn't always as helpful necessarily for the regime survival of dictatorships as you might think. Overall, foreign military aid, you know, if you take sort of all foreign-backed dictatorships and compare them to other autocracies, yes, they last on average a little bit longer. But actually, that relationship is entirely driven by those supported by the Soviet Union. So autocrats backed by the United States and actually as well as France and Great Britain are actually not associated with longer regime tenures. These autocracies actually stay in power about the same number of years as autocrats that don't have any foreign support at all, despite the sort of billions in economic and military aid provided. And, you know, Soviet-backed ones are some of the most resilient dictatorships of the 20th century. And, you know, the book starts with sort of this core puzzle, like, why is it that sort of military aid seems to stabilize some dictatorships and not others? But what mattered was not just sort of, you know, the amount of money and guns and, you know, budgetary support and advisors that foreign powers gave to dictatorships in the Cold War. It mattered who was giving them and what kind of advice they were giving. So, you know, military aid doesn't just strengthen dictatorships, it also transforms them. And the core finding of the book is that military aid from the United States did very different things for the domestic politics of allied dictatorships than military aid from the Soviet Union. And, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union both set about building up militaries in partner regimes in their own image. And this had the kind of unintended effect in terms of the United States of actually destabilizing some of their foreign autocrats by sort of helping support the creation of a formidable internal political rival that is the armed forces. Whereas in Soviet-backed regimes, the Soviet Union provided vital support in subordinating these militaries to the ruling party. And this counted for very different regime survival rates and the surprising resilience of Soviet-backed autocracies.
So, Adam, when you started working on this project, did you already kind of know what you were going to find, or were you really shocked by the finding that support from countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France ended up producing unstable autocracies, I guess would be the term. I mean, were you shocked at the findings, or did you kind of expect it based on looking at a couple key examples that you already knew about?
Yeah, you know, I honestly sort of in the process of gathering the data, I did sort of start to see this pattern seemingly to emerge. I mean, I think I was genuinely surprised right away. I mean, I think, and not just trying to sort of claim methodological purity, but I really didn't know the answer that was I was going to find out when I sort of, you know, set about doing this. And I think, you know, I came from a background of authoritarian politics, and, you know, the book has ended up being probably equally as much about sort of civil military relations and security force structure as it is about a kind of the general theories of authoritarian durability. And I think in part because I found that what really seemed to be accounting for this was this very different sort of threat of military coups. I mean, one of the early findings for the dissertation was just the military never ousted any of these sort of Soviet-backed regimes. And that was really surprising given how common military coups overthrow dictatorships. And, you know, the reverse was absolutely not true in the case of US-backed regimes. There were just sort of countless coups. And I think trying to understand why that was the case was genuinely interesting and surprising to me. And I think the book does a nice job. I was able to sort of add some time in the postdoc, you know, after the PhD to really explore like how these different models of military organization came about in the US and the Soviet Union and why they worked very differently for autocracies and countries in the developing world than, you know, their proponents in Moscow and Washington expected. So yeah, no, I think I was genuinely, you know, somewhat surprised. It's one of those things where I was really excited to actually just sort of see what the numbers really showed and like, what do these 10 years actually look like? Because there are, you know, some long-lasting US-backed regimes, the Saudi royal family, for example, but sort of how sort of comparatively common is that? Is it more common to be one of several military juntas in Guatemala, or is it more common to be sort of the Saudi royal family? And the real answer is Guatemala overall.
I mean, in some ways, the top line finding is not too shocking, that the United States is not as good at producing dictatorships as the Soviet Union. I mean, you would think that a communist dictatorship, a single party state, would have a better idea on how to produce a durable autocracy than the United States, you know, a country that's just founded on the idea of being maybe not a democracy, but having more liberal democratic principles behind its just poor sense of its political identity. I mean, so the top-level finding's not that surprising in a lot of ways, although not really what we think when we talk about it. I mean, we kind of assume that the United States is propping up dictatorships all over the world, and that the reason why a lot of these dictators continue to exist is because the United States is providing all of the support for them. But it does raise a fundamental question, like, I mean, just an even bigger question, which is, why would the United States even want to support autocratic regimes in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, and I think the fact that the U.S. is not probably particularly good at stabilizing autocracies, I agree, you know, it's probably not terribly surprising. I think that the argument for, you know, why the U.S. entered into these alliances with despots is that ultimately U.S. preference for sort of the regime types of its prospective allies really changed a lot over the course of the 20th century, when the U.S. sort of felt like the most succinct answer to this is essentially anti-communism trumped to the preference for democracy among allies. So, you know, in World War II, a lot of these kind of right-wing military juntas in Central America and South America, who had previously expressed admiration for Hitler's Germany or sort of had proto-fascist orientations, are suddenly born again, you know, Democrats, defenders of the free world, and wanted to join the United States and its allies in hemispheric defense. And then, you know, after the Cold War, they were all a brashed, you know, avowed anti-communists and stuff. And I think the U.S. was not naive to the fact that foreign autocrats were constantly attempting to portray themselves as friends to America and America's foreign policy interests. But the triumph of the Soviet Union in 1945 and a series of other kind of quickly, you know, post-war events like the Greek Civil War, the Yugoslav communists seizing power and in Albania, the French Communist Party and the Italian Communist Party poised to what looked like they were going to reap, you know, major electoral victories in Western Europe, the Chinese Revolution in 1949 and the sort of invasion of South Korea by the North in 1950 made the world seem, you know, profoundly more dangerous for American interests than it had before. And I think, you know, looking at the U.S. relationship with somewhere like Thailand is a really instructive window into how shifts in the sort of perceived threateningness of communism really changed American evaluations of, like, why on earth work with some kind of regime that we find fairly abhorrent. I mean, there, you know, Phip Bun was a field marshal who seized power in 1947 in a coup during the war. He'd allied himself with fascist Japan. Not exactly a friend of the United States. The United States was not enamored to him really at all. They were extremely upset about his coup in 1947, such as we were upset about anything in Thailand, which is that it was fairly marginal and the people were upset in Foggy Bottom. I don't know that the American public probably registered much here. And, you know, at the time he was pledging himself to be an anti-communist, wanted to be a member of the free world, and the U.S. was totally uninterested in supporting his government. The events I just mentioned in East Asia really changed our kind of evaluation of whether or not it was worth entering into an alliance with one of these dictators. And, you know, we hoped that they could be kind of pushed to gradually liberalize or to sort of, you know, adopt kind of at least the window dressings of democracy. So, I mean, institutionally, if you squinted, sometimes these looked like democracies, actually. And I think we were quite concerned with kind of prodding them on the margins to kind of appear a little bit more democratic. We pushed Park in South Korea after his coup to, you know, abandon the military fatigues for a business suit and kind of rule as a civilian, even though in practice, you know, it was a military regime through and through. And so we were able to convince ourselves that some of these autocrats weren't, you know, terribly autocratic, or even if they were, they weren't sort of as bad as the totalitarian communists. And then lastly, I think there was a kind of pervasive racist paternalism that sort of thought eventually, yes, they could become democracies. They were maybe too underdeveloped to sustain democratic institutions. And so we ended up kind of coming to terms with the problems of supporting dictators with, you know, kind of varying degrees of comfort throughout the Cold War.
I actually found South Vietnam to be even more fascinating than Thailand, because I didn't realize how many military coups actually happened in the country. I mean, in reading your book, it definitely feels like there's coup after coup after coup that's creating just a completely destabilized environment in a part of the world that my mind just focuses on just the civil war that happened, that the United States was so involved in for more or less a decade, heavily involved within the war. And so you really kind of added this extra wrinkle into it with how unstable the government was during that entire period and how our contribution of military aid was part of the reason why the government itself was actually so unstable. Can you talk a little bit about how our contributions of military aid happened to destabilize Vietnam at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's exactly right too, just in the way you framed that. And then I think we focus a lot on that sort of the conduct of the war in South Vietnam, and we sometimes forget the kind of complicated and messy and extremely robust politics that was going on at the same time, even including when we had sent combat troops, you know, the politics didn't end. And I think the book tries to take that seriously in Afghanistan as well with the Soviets, where like, I think we often think of, oh, the Soviets just took that war over. And it's like, well, they were actually doing a very similar thing in Afghanistan as we were doing in South Vietnam, which was attempting to kind of build an ally and save an ally during a war, not taking over all of the fighting themselves. I mean, that was certainly wasn't their goal, and it certainly wasn't our goal, right? So, yeah, I mean, in South Vietnam, the story begins, you know, really in 1950 or 1954, I suppose, when the sort of the first, you know, U.S. military advising mission comes in. And our goal in South Vietnam is we thought, you know, we'd be able to build, you know, Saigon as this kind of outpost of anti-communism to demonstrate the effectiveness of the sort of American principles of how to build a government and how to build an economy. And that, you know, this was very early on identified as a kind of a key battlefield in the Cold War with sort of, you know, the PRC and later Soviet-aided North Vietnam to the north. And what we did is we set about building the South Vietnamese army to look like our army. This is something we did throughout the Cold War, as the book tries to demonstrate. And I think that's something that's been criticized a lot among scholars who've looked at, you know, U.S. military aid for kind of failing to incorporate effective indigenous cultures, relying on excessively complicated logistics change, like all these reasons why. I mean, a lot of the same stuff came after the Afghan army collapsed in 2021. We sort of built this military that was just too complicated and it looked too much like ours. And, you know, these countries probably aren't institutionally capable of fielding forces like this. But there was also the political problem of building a military that looked like ours, which is that we pushed consistently to make the military autonomous, professional, effective, and in theory, nonpartisan and apolitical. But in practice, we were building this kind of potentially lethal rival to the government in Saigon, who, if we didn't recognize the kind of political problem posed by a strengthening military that was closely tied to the United States, advised, full of kind of new individuals who were coming up and maybe didn't necessarily have political ties to the regime, it was something the regime was very much aware of, right? They were much less naive about the problems posed by this military than we were about the fact that a military, we could strengthen a nonpartisan apolitical military in a fragile dictatorship and not have it becoming a massive political prize for both sides to fight over. And we often kind of complained that our allied government under Ngo Dinh Diem was, you know, kind of irrational, or like, why was it that he was doing all these things like subverting our aid to make it so that political cronies sat in top commands? And why was it that he was, you know, basically trying to divert the resources given to build up an effective military to make sure that the military never ended up reaching effectiveness? And it was because this were the rational behaviors of an autocrat worried about a coup. We were often confused about why that was the case. But so what he did is, you know, he built up a paramilitary alternative. He built several overlapping intelligence agencies. He sort of continually interfered in politics of who staffed the military and who held, you know, which sensitive commands. And, you know, all of this served to basically further upset American advisors who were like, you were kind of messing with this institution that Eisenhower thought would be the key to building an effective South Vietnamese state. And in 1960, in November, you know, this U.S.-built military inculcated a very serious coup attempt that very nearly ousted his regime. And Yem found that we were a far less effective partner when the coup was underway than he might have thought. I mean, he sort of phoned our embassy, and the embassy basically did not give him the kind of unequivocal support he was expecting, and his U.S.-trained paratroopers very nearly ousted his government. But actually, his coup-proofing strategies worked in this case, and the paramilitary Civil Guard fought off the coup attempt until loyalists could come. But it kind of reinforced for him that he was, in fact, correct to view the U.S.-trained army as a serious threat to his rule, and the failure of the coup made him redouble rather than kind of walk back from his efforts to coup-proof the military. And, you know, the end result was, you know, even more kind of purges of the military command and disgruntlement. And ultimately, we ended up, you know, providing support for a coup that ousted him 3 years later. And after that, there were a half a dozen other regime changes over the next couple of years. So it was, you know, this coup, the 1963 coup, hardly brought the stability we were hoping for. And in fact, you know, sort of a series of additional coups didn't really kind of stabilize until the mid-1960s.
Vietnam South Vietnam is also a great example of how autocrats sometimes get in the way of creating an effective military force. And so the United States wants the most effective military force possible to be able to take on the North Vietnamese, while the person in charge of the country doesn't want a military that's too effective, because that means that that military could actually seize power, that they could actually attack him and take the country over. So you've got this really weird dynamic. And this happens in so many autocracies, where the autocrat doesn't want a powerful military, when normally we would think of an autocrat wanting this all-powerful military. We just think of them kind of like a Darth Vader figure. But in reality, a lot of times they want super weak militaries that aren't very effective at fighting wars. And yet that's exactly what the United States government desperately wants, desperately needs, is an effective military to be able to fight the communists. It's such a bizarre dynamic and dance that you're kind of dealing with when you're providing military aid for these dictatorships.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, the Soviets have a somewhat more mixed record than we do on this, but they were not kind of immune from this problem either. It's just sort of generally the case that it is very difficult to prod an allied dictatorship to build an effective military for the reasons you just said, right? The sort of the political problem posed by military effectiveness. And I think that, you know, the Soviets were able to build militaries and allied governments that were not the same political threat, because they sort of replicated the Soviet system of control. But they struggled as well with building like effective military. They could not build up Afghan military capacity to the extent they wanted to. Ethiopia, kind of a similar story.
So the West, the United States, France, Britain, they tried to build militaries that reflect democratic principles, where you have a division of power, separation of power, where the military is somewhat independent, it's professional, it's apolitical. And that becomes a problem because you're creating a separate power center within the country. And that's the reason why that becomes a coup threat to a dictator who's in power. If he wants to tell the military to do something that they don't want to do, he's less professional, less legitimate in a lot of ways, that the military feels that they're entitled to be able to run the country if they think that the political leaders are incompetent. You mentioned the Soviet system. I don't want to say does a better job, because this is all about creating stable autocrats, and I'm not sure that that's ever a good thing to happen, but they do a better job of creating stable autocracies, even while giving military aid. What is the Soviet system? How is it different than what the United States and other Western countries are doing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Soviet Union is often remembered for its kind of institutional failures, the command economy being maybe the most famous example, right? Like when we think of the Soviet institutions, we think of largely sort of them negatively as things that were sort of abysmal failures. But I think one of their maybe most underappreciated organizational innovations was the partisan army. When the Bolsheviks seized power in their kind of lightning insurrection in Petrograd, they had a really big problem, which was that it had kind of only a smattering of armed supporters, and they had kind of sympathetic soldiers in the local garrison, and that was about it. And I mean, the Tsarist army was in a state of kind of collapse at that point, but it was still this giant military behemoth full of officers who had a lot to lose from radical communists taking over. So they were in this really vulnerable position after the revolution, and like most Marxists of their time, they were really hostile to standing militaries. So Trotsky, who was later put in charge of building the Red Army, was kind of one of the most foremost kind of military thinkers among the Bolsheviks. And he'd given a lot of thought to like what to do about the problem of the army. They were very early on committed to abolishing the Tsarist army, which they saw as both a kind of aristocratic bourgeois kind of hotbed. So, you know, at the time, these kind of aristocratic officers were giving away to more professionals, but those were still terrible if you were a communist because they were thoroughly bourgeois. And the men were sort of peasants in uniforms. And Mao was really the first one to appreciate the revolutionary potential of the peasants. The Bolsheviks were not terribly keen on the peasantry. And so they really early on wanted to get rid of the military, but they faced this kind of tremendous looming existential threat. And so they sort of quickly set about, okay, well, we can't just rely on the Red Guards. And we know that these kind of sympathetic local soldiers, we have no real control over them. If they stop being so sympathetic, we're really in trouble. And so they set about building a new military. And their solution to the problem of the military was the same solution as their problem to the problem of the revolution, which is that, you know, the mass party would be able to solve Bonapartism. They were terrified of this. If you rely, if you create this new military, the military is going to ultimately kill the revolution, right? And so they set about, they're like, we need to create a proper military, but it needs to be red and expert. And the fundamental problem was they didn't have that many proletarian Communist Party members who were actually proficient in kind of, you know, in military science or, you know, trained military officers. And so they put themselves in this kind of terrible position where they decided they needed to enlist former Imperial Army officers. And their solution to how to keep these officers from destroying the revolution was to embed next to them, the name would change several times over the course of the Red Army, but political commissars, which were these kind of party members who would early on under this system of called dual command would countersign the orders of the officer. And so they were there to kind of ensure ideological conformity within the military unit, and most importantly, to monitor and provide a check on the behavior of the professional military officer. And a probably equally, if not more important aspect of this system was actually that alongside both the commander and the commissar was embedded a third person, and this was a member of the secret police. And so the security service that the Bolsheviks established, it also would come through sort of many different forms. It was first called the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission, CHK, and it would later gain notoriety as the NKVD, and then eventually the KGB. And they operated this group within the security service called the Special Department. And the special department was an embedded military counterintelligence wing. And so by military counterintelligence, the Soviets had a particular vision of what that means. In Western circles, military counterintelligence would be making sure that your, you know, military services were not penetrated by foreign spy agencies or foreign governments. But the Soviets saw a foreign hand in basically all form of domestic opposition. And so anyone who was sort of potentially hostile to the Soviet government, you know, whatever kind of political opposition, was almost definitionally acting on behalf of Western or, you know, sort of enemies of the Soviet state abroad. So in practice, these military counterintelligence officers were sort of focused on rooting out potential political opposition.
So what you're saying is the counterintelligence wasn't focused so much on foreign threats. It was focused on the threat from within.
Exactly. And that was the distinction that the Soviets basically considered to be a distinction without difference, right? So any kind of domestic political threat, especially at this period, was almost certainly directed by, you know, the enemies of Soviet communism outside of the country. This kind of matrix of the political commissar, the military commander, and the military counterintelligence officer, coupled with a big push to promote party membership in the military, ended up kind of jointly comprising the partisan army. And the Soviets, you know, they weren't the first to have technically any of these exact institutions, but to have them operating in concert at every level of the military, responding to a single mass party, was a sort of early Soviet innovation. And it proved, you know, remarkably good at protecting the Soviet government from a threat from the military. And it enabled what is, in comparative terms, an absolutely stunning assault on the military hierarchy, which was Stalin's Great Purges, where he had sort of 60% of people above brigadier generals, or kombrig was the Soviet term, were executed by the end of the Purges. It's difficult to conceive of a more stark assault on a military that was unanswered. You know, there was no reactive coup attempt because the embedded security services were able to so thoroughly carry out these purges and stuff in the Soviet Union. So anyways, this ends up being a pretty effective tool of Soviet control over its own military. And it's one that the Soviets actually export abroad. It's one that's emulated to some extent. There are some organizations that sort of see the Soviet model and attempt to replicate it themselves without much Soviet direction, sometimes not even understanding how that model exactly worked. So in Eritrea, the EPLF emulates the Soviet model, but they're actually fighting a Soviet-backed government. And so the Soviets aren't aiding them at all. They have some vision of what they imagine the Soviet-style military is supposed to look like, and all of the military commanders just call themselves commissars. And so it's not a real institution copy, but the general point being that, you know, the Soviets are actually able to export this model really effectively to their allied regimes, and it's quite good at keeping the regime to power.
Eritrea is a little bit of a separate case because that's a revolutionary government. And that kind of fits into Lucan Way and Stephen Levitsky's big argument that social revolutionary governments are much more durable autocracies. And to be honest, Adam, I mean, you've co-written papers with them on that topic, so I'm sure you're familiar with that argument.
I am, yeah. There's another article in 2020 where actually us, along with Jean LaChapelle, we wrote a piece on social revolution, and then Steve and Lucan wrote an amazing book in 2022. So yes, Lucan, full disclosure, was my dissertation advisor, and I've known Steve for many years as well. So, and I helped do some of the data collection for that project. But yes, so I think the Soviet-backed regimes include a decent number of indigenous revolutionary regimes that carried out their own revolutionary seizures of power. Some aided in varying degrees during the kind of road to power, like the Chinese communists, Angola and Mozambique, and others that received aid like Cuba only after, you know, several years after they were already in power. So there's a, you know, decent amount of overlap between the kind of indigenous revolutions, but there's also these imposed by the Soviets or aided by the Soviets.
So the social revolution argument always makes a great deal of sense because it provides an impetus, like a reason for that to happen organically. What's interesting in this book that you've written, is that even while the social revolution may not exist, that they're able to export that form of military, or at least enough of that form of a military, to those countries to create durable autocracies outside these revolutionary contexts. I mean, I think that's really one of the things that's very surprising about your book. I mean, it has a lot of similarities to the social revolution argument that Levitsky Way, and like you said, yourself and La Chapelle made in that article, and Levitsky and Way made in the book. But it's interesting that they're able to export those armies so that they're able to create durable autocracies outside of the context of revolutions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of it as, you know, there's sort of three ways that if you're an autocrat, you can end up getting a military that you sort of thoroughly dominate and institutionally penetrate. And so, I mean, the thing is, the reason not every autocrat can do this is that the system I described, where your commands are being kind of countersigned by a sometimes much more junior than you political appointee, and a member of the secret police is kind of watching every one of your moves, that's obviously not a terribly popular system of military organization, and it's not one that military officers like, right? And so I think, you know, the reason not every autocrat does this is it's very difficult to pull this off. So I think there's really only three ways in which you can get a military like this. One is luck. One is that you attempt to install this system. You face a reactive coup attempt, but you survive. That is, you know, you can, for whatever reason, the coup fails. And I think this is the kind of Muammar Gaddafi path to building a subordinate military, is that he is very nearly ousted in 1975. And several times since, he faces, you know, near miss assassination attempts and such, but he's able to, with every kind of failed attempt to oust him, he's able to institutionalize more and more subordination of his military. And by the time the regime is ousted, you know, the military can't even access ammunition without the permission of military intelligence and stuff like that. And so you have, you know, that path, you have the kind of luck path, but, you know, for every Gaddafi or as I point out, Nyerere in Tanzania, you have Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, who tries to do all this kind of stuff. And the military ousts him in 66 because they sort of identify this as a serious risk to their corporate interests. The second path you have is indigenous revolution, right? You can kind of build your own army and capture state power on your own. And then the third path is the Soviets can impose it for you. Those are really the three ways that you get these types of militaries. And, you know, even in the imposition cases, and I think what the book sort of adds in addition to the great work by Stephen Lukin is some of the kind of benefits of revolutionary origins, mostly being highly loyal and, you know, reasonably effective security apparatuses, are also possible through sort of Soviet imposition. There's a kind of another path in addition to the kind of, hey, you lucked out and, you know, won out, even though you very easily could have been ousted path. There's this kind of Soviet imposed way to do it.
Let's get back to the American case where the Americans are providing military aid and it's actually destabilizing these autocracies, because that is a bit shocking. I mean, we think of one of the reasons to kind of be upset with American foreign policy is that it's propping up dictatorships. But you're finding that we're not propping up dictatorships, we're propping up militaries who are sometimes overthrowing those dictatorships. But I think it's probably important to say, like, what kind of governments are emerging from this? Because I don't get the impression that these militaries are overthrowing autocrats and then bringing about democratization. I mean, I get the impression that they're just bringing about new autocracies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the book tries to sort of look at the effectiveness of these strategies rather than, you know, is this good or bad? But I think it is worth noting for the reader, right? Like, the U.S. certainly tried to prop up plenty of dictatorships. This isn't like a kind of, the U.S. was never in the business of attempting to stabilize unpopular autocratic governments. Like, that did happen repeatedly. But as you said, what ended up happening is kind of our methods by which we attempted to stabilize regimes often ended up leading to military coups, which military coups did not necessarily bring, you know, democracy or elections. Sometimes they brought elections, but they weren't terribly democratic. What they ended up bringing was sometimes completely explicit military juntas. Sometimes they brought military regimes where, in practice, the whatever sort of officer had led the coup might don a business suit and run in kind of heavily stage managed elections as a civilian president. But in practice, the military was indirectly ruling. What the end result was more autocracy, but it was just unstable autocracy. And these, you know, military regimes are not immune from coup threats themselves. In fact, they're some of the most coup prone types of autocracies. So, you know, it was not the case that, okay, once the military ousted the disliked autocrat, they suddenly solved all their kind of factional political problems. Like, no, they still had all sorts of politics within the military again. And, you know, now you're worried about your brigadier generals and your majors and your colonels. And I mean, actually, it's one of the most durable findings of coups in recent research is coups beget coups. They end up leading to far more coup attempts. So it was the case that the U.S. certainly attempted to stabilize friendly autocrats who pledged anti-communism. We ended up not necessarily stabilizing them in the ways that we might have imagined, but the end result was a series of sort of pro-American juntas who replaced other pro-American juntas.
So when I'm reading your book, when I'm hearing these arguments, I mean, my mind immediately goes to Samuel Huntington and his thoughts about modernization. I mean, that's just where my mind is drawn. And one of his big insights about modernization was that political modernization functions differently than economic modernization. Like, they're not always on the same track. And the military is oftentimes modernized much faster than the rest of society, which is part of the reason why we have military coups, because militaries feel that they're entitled to be able to run the country. They think that they're the ones who actually are the most professional, the most business-oriented, the most legitimate institutions within the country. So when they see people who are running the country that don't know what they're doing, they think maybe we should actually take over and actually fix things. One of the things in the back of my mind here is, why is it that the United States and other Western countries are taking steps to modernize the military significantly faster than all of the other institutions in the country? Because the easiest fix to this would be, let's not make it so that the military is modernized much quicker than other political institutions like legislatures, rule of law, other things like that. Why is it that we didn't put more emphasis in other aspects of the country? Why is it that we put all of our eggs into the military basket?
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to say, you know, first, all the while we're providing military aid, in fairness to American administrations in the Cold War, they didn't think the only way to stop anti-communism would be to build, you know, effective anti-communist militaries. They just thought it would be one sort of really key aspect of it and ended up being the kind of primary form of sort of regime support we gave. But we gave a lot of, you know, economic aid. We promoted land reform. We sort of did these things that we thought might lead to good development. So I think probably the answer to the question is that it's harder to do those other things. I don't know that the record suggests that it's very easy to build legitimate functioning governments or strong institutions in other areas. And I think militaries are something that we maybe sort of have a more defined problem set and kind of some ability to, and again, we're not terribly good at making them very militarily effective, but we can end up kind of, you know, modernizing their structures and kind of building them along our line. We have a bunch of, you know, military officers who can serve as advisors, and they sort of recreate sort of institutions we have at home and hope they work. And I'll just say just quickly on how you led that question, which I thought was really great. I think, you know, Samuel Huntington, I think, is his work on civil military relations and that political order is so good. And that one of his most profound insights is, like, look, the only way to really ever stop the problem of praetorianism or, like, you know, militaries ousting governments is by making, you know, military coups unthinkable. Like, you need to have a fully legitimate political system in order for the military to kind of never contemplate being involved. And I think in practice, what, you know, what autocrats do is they don't really make coups unthinkable. They make them too difficult to carry out, you know. And I think the way that Western democracies prevent coups is it's not typically by coup-proofing. I mean, there is a little bit of that goes on. And I think Wilkinson's book on India shows really well that, like, there's traditional coup-proofing going on in India. And then there's also this kind of benefit of the Indian army finding kind of a coup increasingly kind of outside the norms of what a military would do or should do or something like that. So making them unthinkable is probably the only way to durably remove the sort of threat of military coups. And that's sort of the second best thing you can do is kind of subordinate the military institutionally to a ruling party or ruling regime. And your third best option is to fragment the security apparatus and hope that some of your new counterweights will fight back against the others. So it sort of exists on a continuum of these different strategies. And autocrats, I mean, they don't, it's not like we just sort of, they pick them from a chart and they're like, okay, what kind of coup-proofing strategy should I do now that I came to office? You're heavily constrained by the kind of constellation of security forces that already exist, right? So the revolutionary governments are able to effectively institutionalized control over their militaries because they're able to build them from scratch, right? I mean, I think it's much harder to embed these institutions in existing forces that have incentives to resist.
Most of my listeners, probably all of my listeners, don't really care if an autocrat loses power. I mean, they believe in democracy. They support democracy. Should we really care if an autocrat falls to a military coup? Should we care if the military aid that we're providing to some of these autocrats ends up removing them from power? Does it matter?
So I think it does matter, basically, not because we should care if autocrats remain in power or we should find it too upsetting that, you know, USAID didn't actually stabilize dictatorships. I think obviously that seems plausibly like a victory. But the problem is that it destabilized these governments and these militaries ultimately in ways that end up dragging the United States kind of further and further into interventions to have to sort of save beleaguered regimes. So these coups, again, did not bring actual stability. They brought more counter coups and further kind of spirals of instability in the government that further wreaked havoc on kind of military capacity in ways that ended up, you know, dragging the United States further into interventions to save beleaguered governments just when the U.S. was trying to kind of extract itself and try to build up indigenous capacity. And so I think, you know, if we are concerned about the types of interventions that led the United States in further and further, you know, we do need to understand and care about these kind of political dynamics. And I think the counterargument, obviously, and it's worth caveating on the autocracy point, like, yes, you know, these Soviet-backed dictatorships were more stable insofar as they sort of lasted in power longer, but they were, you know, horrifically repressive and unpopular and presided over like economic devastation. And so, yeah, you know, most autocratic, or all, I suppose, or most, I'll be a cagey analyst, but like, you know, they don't really bring lasting stability, right? This is all kind of ephemeral. And the Soviet-backed regimes left these militaries that were used to being penetrated by existing regimes. And there haven't been very many, you know, military coups and post-communist roles, Brian Taylor showed. So there are some kind of interesting inheritances and stuff like that. But these were not good governments that they kept in power. And it's squarely focused on kind of explaining authoritarian durability. And it isn't that it was good what the Soviets did.
So, Adam, I know that you're focused on foreign autocrats, but what about democracies? Like, can military aid destabilize democracies, particularly if they have weak institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main way you can stabilize democracies is by leading to, you know, military coups, right? So basically, like, I think, and, you know, he wasn't really a Democrat, but like Ri in South Korea, I mean, he was early on kind of autocratic streak, and by a little bit, he's kind of plausibly viewed as an autocrat, but, you know, he's kind of initially seemed democratic. You know, ultimately, the U.S. sort of built up this military that viewed its coup in 61, or, well, he was ousted in 60, but like against the interim government, it sort of viewed its intervention in 61 against civilians as an extension of its kind of military duties and not a betrayal of its professionalism. So if we teach kind of what proper civil military norms are supposed to look like to these military officers, and then in practice, these governments try to use the army in repression, or they sort of bring it into politics, then sometimes these coups can be seen incorrectly, but ironically, as kind of actually extensions of military professionalism and violations of it.
Well, the most famous example would be Chile, I think, where you have a military overthrowing a democratically elected government. But Chile's got all kinds of different caveats involved. Where did the United States government actually encourage the coup? What exactly was happening there? I think a more interesting example would be what's happening in a more contemporary case, which would be Niger, where we were providing significant military aid to Niger to be able to fight terrorists, and the military decided to overthrow a democratically elected government. I mean, do you think the fact that we were overly focused on security in Africa might have contributed not just to the coup in Niger, but maybe some of the other coups that are happening in kind of Western Africa right now?
Well, so as I point out in the book, in the kind of after the Cold War chapter, you know, military coups declined dramatically in the early 1990s and continued to decline through the 2010s. And this decline was not, you know, because the U.S. stopped giving military aid to countries, or we stopped providing security assistance, or, you know, there were some curricular changes, as I point out in the book, that, you know, some of our military training came to emphasize civilian control of the military more consistently. And there's a little bit more kind of human rights curriculum, which some of that had existed before. But, you know, coups didn't decline because we somehow, you know, got better at giving security assistance and not building up militaries that were capable or willing to overthrow their governments. And again, not saying the U.S. wanted these coups, but like, it wasn't that the U.S., you know, somehow got better at preventing predatory impulses, it was that the value of holding office after a successful coup declines because coup makers are met with sanctions, right? So it isn't that officers get worse at carrying out coups, or the kind of factors that lead them to be motivated to carry out coups are somehow gone after the end of the Cold War. It's that when they seize power, which is a highly visible to the international community, sort of not ambiguous at all. You know, when you look at the international community punishing democratic backsliding, it's often very subtle and slow, right? Like, when under Chavez did it backslide? You know, like, what is the event that actually led Venezuelan democracy to collapse? And it's not actually necessarily always very obvious. And so I think coups are a real focal point, clear violation of democracy and of civilian control of the military. And they're met by sanctions, and they're met by fairly consistent and unified international sanctions. And so American unipolarity and the alignment of kind of the IMF and the World Bank and the European Union and ECOWAS and the AU, they end up kind of all coming together to resoundingly condemn these coups. And so in 2015, the coup in Burkina Faso is met with this kind of vehement, you know, international response, surprises the military officers. They step down sort of 7 to 9 days later. And I think that the big change, and I think that's something that, you know, other analysts have pointed out and I point out in the book, is, you know, as the era of American unipolarity ends, and I think whatever one thinks about the current period, whether it's some kind of new Cold War or something else, there's sort of broad agreement it's a period of strategic competition. And the president said, you know, the era of unipolarity is definitely over or something like that. And so I think as that ends, there's a potential for juntas to seize on fractures in the international response and on a different, no longer unified kind of international response to their coups. And so I think this period of a major uptick in the last 3 years, you know, as I say in the book, this is something that, you know, unfortunately, understanding the dynamics of military coups is unlikely to be only a historically relevant phenomenon. I think some of the factors that led to coups in the first Cold War are probably going to be present in the future. And so, yes, this kind of changes in the international environment, I think, are playing a role there, as I say in the book.
What I notice is that after the end of the Cold War, we put a lot more emphasis into the legitimacy of elections. And what we've struggled to do is figure out how to react when those elections become less and less legitimate through democratic backsliding. And so you have cases like Venezuela that you mentioned, where Chavez erodes the democratic system within the country, and then you have Maduro, who takes it down a notch even further. But you have elections throughout the entire process. So it's really hard to say that it's not democratic, even as the elections become less and less fair and, to a large extent, less and less free. I mean, it's hard to be able to kind of pin down where the line is between democracy and autocracy if you're using elections really as the sole benchmark between the two. And in the case of a coup, I mean, you're overriding an election. I mean, it's very obvious what's going on. So if you're using elections as kind of the institution that you're trying to make stronger, that's the key institution that you're focused on rather than militaries. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that you might have democratic backsliding that's done by people who win elections, but in cases where people are trying to dismiss elections or try to get rid of electoral outcomes like a military, that those would be things that the international community would react very harshly to. What I'm noticing, though, in Africa seems to be very different, where we seem to be putting the focus yet again, instead of focusing on elections, we seem to be putting a tremendous focus on strengthening their militaries. It feels very much like something that harkens back to those Cold War days, because we were so focused on destroying terrorism within those areas, and the institutions surrounding those countries were so weak that it feels like maybe we were making the same mistakes we made during the Cold War. I mean, do you see any parallels between the way that we've been handling particularly the Sahel region within Africa and the way that we handled a lot of other countries during the Cold War?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that as we look to the future, I think if we see this kind of return, or to the extent we're seeing this return to kind of focusing on building up security forces, that failing to consider the political context in which a strengthening military or stronger special forces or sort of enclave units, as I point out in that post-Cold War chapter, you know, failing to appreciate the political uses of these forces in addition to their kind of military purpose, would risk sort of, you know, a repeat of some of the dynamics we saw before. And I think even if we don't necessarily care about those political effects or something, it's worth considering how what we think might be strengthening a military force can end up over the medium and longer term actually undermining political stability, right? So I think we had periods where we thought we were building stronger militaries and we thought we were strengthening these militaries in the Cold War. And in fact, the sort of political effects of those strengthened militaries ended up leading to, you know, a longer term deterioration in stability. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the book tries to grapple a little bit with what, you know, we learn and what we don't learn from, I guess, the first Cold War. And I think it is a reasonable question.
Well, Adam, it's a fascinating book. It really kind of raises a lot of questions. Once again, the book is called Up in Arms: How Military Aid Stabilizes and Destabilizes Foreign Autocrats. It's one of the better books that I've read so far this year. I know it's early into the year, but even compared to last year, it's one of the stronger books. Congratulations for writing it. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and saying those very kind words. It really means a lot.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.